Welcome to the debate. Today, we confront an urgent challenge, the accelerating loss of biodiversity and the degradation of our ecosystems. Now, this isn't just a problem for remote wilderness areas. It demands immediate attention and really action from residential landowners right in our own backyards. So we're exploring the most effective and practical approaches for managing these residential landscapes, specifically focusing on the role of native versus non-native plant species. My position centers on the imperative for landowners to drastically shift towards prioritizing keystone native plants for their unparalleled ecological function because, well, I believe the science clearly dictates this.
And I'm approaching this, well, slightly differently. While I fully agree that the decline in biodiversity is a critical issue, it absolutely demands our attention, I believe the path to ecological restoration in our, you know, managed landscapes is complex. It's not always straightforward. We really need to acknowledge the significant challenges, the practical challenges, of implementation for the average homeowner, and consider whether some non-native species might, perhaps in certain contexts, play a limited, maybe occasional ecological role.
Right. The current state of our ecosystems, it's marked by drastic species loss and habitat fragmentation, and this necessitates an urgent and widespread transformation of our residential landscapes. Plants are Earth's lifeblood, yes, but maybe more vividly, they're the solar-powered engines that drive nearly every terrestrial food web, filtering our water, producing our oxygen. When we compromise them with non-natives, we're essentially throwing a wrench into that engine. Our research consistently demonstrates that native plants, especially those keystone genera like oaks, you know, those foundational plant groups supporting a disproportionately large number of species, provide far more sustenance for insect herbivores. And these are the very foundation of terrestrial food webs, far more compared to non-natives. This isn't just an aesthetic choice people make for their gardens. It's an ecological imperative and, frankly, a profound responsibility each landowner holds. The measurable benefits of this approach, even on the smallest plots of land, contribute to what we call a homegrown national park. This isn't merely about personal gardening. It's really about leveraging our collective residential spaces to create a national-scale ecological corridor. It's a practical solution to habitat fragmentation that empowers every single homeowner as a frontline conservationist.
That's certainly a compelling vision. And I absolutely appreciate the gravity of the ecological decline you're highlighting and the scientific basis for prioritizing those keystone species. However, when we translate this vision to individual homeowners, well, that's where we run into significant friction. While embracing native plants is, without doubt, a powerful tool, it's just not always a straightforward path. Homeowners encounter pretty significant practical challenges, things like the upfront cost of native plants, the sheer labor involved in replacing existing landscapes, and, you know, prevailing societal norms and regulations. Think about HOA policies that often favor traditional lawns over diverse native plantings. Furthermore, a strict native-only approach, it might overlook some limited ecological contributions from certain non-native species, or perhaps it underestimates the natural resilience and adaptability of some native fauna. You know, is the risk of alienating a majority with an all-or-nothing approach really worth the potential for a more impactful, but maybe less widespread adoption? I tend to believe our focus should be on practical, sustainable solutions that encourage widespread adoption, even if they involve a more gradual or compromised transition, rather than an all-or-nothing approach that might just overwhelm individual efforts.
Okay. I grasp your point on the practical realities, I do, but I must push back on the idea that these challenges somehow outweigh the ecological imperative. The evidence is just so clear regarding the profound ecological impact of non-native plants, particularly the invasive ones. They are, quite frankly, severe ecological disruptors. They decimate local biodiversity. Consider the studies on invaded hedgerows, which show a shocking 68% fewer caterpillar species and 96% less caterpillar biomass. That's the total living weight of caterpillars compared to native ones.
This isn't a minor dip we're talking about. It's a systemic collapse right at the base of the food web. Native insects, like the eastern tent caterpillar, they simply cannot adapt quickly to alien plants. We've seen them refuse to eat Japanese honeysuckle leaves, even when they're facing starvation, literally walking right over them to find every last native cherry leaf.
Species like the Melaleuca paper bark tree, for instance, dramatically reduce local insect and animal populations down in the Everglades because native insects just cannot consume their leaves. This disrupts the entire food web for everything from birds right up to alligators. This loss, right at the base, it reverberates profoundly, leading to stark differences. For example, mockingbirds being twice as abundant in native prairies compared to those invaded by buffel grass. So how do you reconcile that limited benefit you mentioned from some non-natives with this overwhelming evidence of systemic disruption caused by widely adopted non-natives?
Right. I see why you emphasize that stark contrast. And I certainly agree that invasive plants undeniably pose significant threats. But the issue isn't always as black and white as purely severe ecological disruptors. Some non-native plants, particularly the non-invasive ones, can offer limited yet maybe still valuable benefits to wildlife. For example, it is true that some alien plants produce berries that provide crucial energy for migrating and overwintering birds, even if they don't support, say, nestlings directly. Additionally, some non-native ornamentals, think of certain Asian crabapples or weeping willows, they're chemically similar enough to native species that North American insects, including, remarkably, over 300 species of Lepidoptera, you know, moths and butterflies, can actually utilize them as host plants. This is particularly true where hybridization occurs. Even introduced insects like aphids that arrived with Siberian elm or Norway spruce can become an opportunistic food source for birds, demonstrating that birds are not always quite as selective as we might assume. And let's not overlook the ecological value of some native annuals, often just dismissed as weeds, things like ditch daisy or common jewelweed, which supports specialist insects and hummingbirds. Even poison ivy, which most people hate, offers high-fat berries for birds and pollen for bees, and it hosts 19 species of specialist moths. So does a purely native approach truly account for the adaptability of some insects or the limited but still real benefits some non-invasives offer, particularly perhaps from the migrating birds in urban environments where natives might be scarce?
That's an interesting point about adaptability and specific benefits, though I would frame it quite differently. While some non-natives might offer these, let's call them incidental benefits, the overwhelming data still points to a fundamental disruption of the foundational food web. But, okay, beyond the ecological impact, let's turn our attention to the how, the practicality of this transformation. You've raised significant barriers, and I'd like to address those directly. I'm just not convinced that implementation is as difficult as it's sometimes made out to be, nor that it necessarily needs to be slow. Transforming our landscapes is not only possible, but I argue urgently necessary. Our lawns, covering this astounding 40 million acres in North America, are essentially biologically sterile landscapes. They contribute significantly to stormwater runoff. They don't store carbon effectively, and they require polluting fertilizers and pesticides, adding carbon every single time they're mowed. Now, while starting trees from seed is practically free, and yields healthier, well-shaped trees that gain size surprisingly quickly. Our red oaks can reach 6 feet in just 5 years. Immediate action can also involve removing turf grass through methods like smothering, maybe with plastic or builder's paper, or if necessary, the targeted, limited use of herbicides as a kind of chemotherapy to facilitate replacement with natives. Furthermore, biocontrol using specialist insects to manage invasives is a highly effective and rigorously regulated tool these days. We should embrace it. And no longer poses the risks of past failures seen in, you know, earlier attempts decades ago. It is our collective responsibility to implement these changes, even if it starts small, on an eighth of an acre, because the cumulative impact is what creates a truly resilient, homegrown national park.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that it's always practical for every single homeowner, or that the barriers are quite so easily overcome. Implementing widespread landscape transformation presents, I think, really significant practical hurdles for many people. The cost.
Just the cost of purchasing and installing a large number of native plants can be prohibitive for many families, making free, natural colonization from the existing seed bank or maybe animal dispersal a more accessible, albeit much slower, method for achieving some level of restoration. The whole idea of instant gratification that many homeowners want, it often clashes with the longer-term perspective needed for native planting. For instance, planting 3-foot oak seedlings, as you mentioned, is actually far more challenging and often less successful than starting from acorns, which just requires patience. Furthermore, the very idea of herbicide use, even targeted use for turf removal, raises legitimate concerns about volatilization, meaning, you know, the chemicals becoming airborne, of things like chloroacetamide herbicides, which have been linked to oak tatters and could potentially harm human lungs and other species. And the general use of insecticides, even some dormant oils, can indiscriminately kill beneficial insects, including their eggs, pupae, and caterpillars. Natural pest control methods like, say, tolerating tulip tree aphids so ladybird beetles can control them, require a level of patience and tolerance for pests that many gardeners simply lack. And beyond individual effort, city ordinances and HOA rules also frequently restrict uncontrolled growth and heavily favor traditional lawns, presenting significant hurdles to adoption that are often beyond a homeowner's immediate control. Are we not risking alienating the very people we need to bring into this movement by setting expectations that might be too high or too costly for many?
Okay, I understand those practical concerns, and I don't deny they exist. But they so often seem to overshadow the fundamental ecological imperative. Ecological value must be our primary driver, not just aesthetics or ease of maintenance. A landscape's stability and its productivity are directly linked to the number of interacting species it supports. Keystone plants like oaks are absolutely critical for building complex, stable food webs. They support hundreds of caterpillar species. For example, northern white oak supports 283 species, red oak 213. Without these keystone genera, these foundational plants, landscape supports 70 to 75% fewer caterpillar species. That fundamentally collapses the food web. Our current aesthetic-driven gardening practices have created functionally collapsed ecosystems, effectively turning once vibrant areas into, well, monoculture deserts. I'm just not convinced by the line of reasoning that a few non-natives can be integrated without significant ecological cost, because the core problem remains the replacement of functionality. A non-native might offer a superficial benefit, like a berry, perhaps, but it rarely replaces the entire suite of ecological interactions a native keystone species provides throughout its life cycle, from hosting larval stages to offering specialized nectar and shelter. We're not just swapping out parts here. We're fundamentally altering the intricate machinery of an ecosystem, and those cumulative compromises, they can lead to collapse. We must aim for at least 70% native plant biomass in our yards to sustain breeding bird populations. This is a measurable target. It's not just some philosophical ideal.
Well, while I absolutely agree that keystone species are undeniably important, and your figures on their support for insect species are compelling, the idea that every native plant automatically contributes a lot to the food web is probably a simplification. Some native plants, like that poison ivy we mentioned earlier, which does have benefits, or certain ferns and even some tulip trees, they host relatively few insect species compared to something like an oak. Furthermore, I still contend that not every landscape needs to be 100% native to be ecologically valuable. There is room for compromise. A healthy dose of keystone plant genera, as the source material puts it, can often accommodate some striking, non-invasive introduced ornamentals without losing their fundamental ecological clout, that is, their essential ability to support the foundational food web and ecosystem services.
The focus, I believe, should also extend beyond just maximizing insect populations to maintaining overall ecosystem health, including soil quality. For instance, adding compost to soil, while often considered beneficial, isn't something that happened naturally in all ecosystems, and choosing plants adapted to existing soil pH is often more important and sustainable than trying to alter the soil itself. Even cultivars, you know, cultivated varieties, while genetically less diverse, might offer benefits like disease resistance or size control. This could potentially increase native plant adoption in ways that might be ecologically neutral in terms of insect use if they're carefully selected. This kind of pragmatic approach, I think, might achieve wider adoption than a more absolutist stance.
I see why you think a more pragmatic approach could lead to wider adoption, but I remain unconvinced that a small ecological compromise is truly neutral, or that it doesn't ultimately chip away at the maximal ecological function we desperately need right now. Is it really a compromise if that compromise means losing species diversity in the long run?
That's a fair challenge. It is. However, I would counter that a slight ecological compromise might indeed lead to wider adoption and, maybe in aggregate, a greater overall positive impact across a larger landscape, rather than having just a few perfect but isolated native havens. It's really a question of scale and achievable change, isn't it?
Perhaps, but the measurable decline in biodiversity suggests we have precious little room for anything other than prioritizing maximal ecological function, especially when you consider those critical species-specific interactions. Our discussion today has certainly highlighted both the profound ecological imperative to restore native plants to our residential landscapes and also the intricate practicalities and diverse viewpoints that shape how we approach this vital task. We've considered the undeniable, measurable benefits of prioritizing keystone native species for a robust food web,
right,
as well as the significant challenges of transitioning from established landscaping norms, including cost, societal perceptions, and the, yes, nuanced ecological roles some non-natives might play in specific contexts.
Indeed. We've delved into the complexities of implementing these changes and acknowledged that what's ecologically ideal isn't always immediately practical or universally appealing for every single homeowner. The path forward likely involves a blend of ambition and adaptability, requiring careful thought on where exactly to draw the lines of compromise for maximum overall benefit.
Absolutely. We've seen that the scientific evidence strongly supports the role of native plants, especially those keystone species, in maintaining ecosystem health and stability. But we've also grappled with the human factors, everything from cost to community regulations, that significantly impact the rate and the method of adoption. Ultimately, the question of how to best manage our yards remains a personal and a community-level decision, one that invites careful consideration of both ecological science and, well, human practicalities. Each of us in our own spaces holds the potential to contribute to a more vibrant and sustainable future, and there are certainly more to explore in the material as we continue to shape our understanding of how to balance this ecological urgency with practical implementation.